Today on Political Rewind, Georgia elected officials react to the publication of the Mueller report. Campaign cash is pouring into the coffers of congressional candidates. Governor Kemp signs a breakthrough medical marijuana law. All that and more, Political Rewind starts now. Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. Really glad to have you all with us today. Of course, the big news that's been dominating the political headlines and most of the general headlines, for that matter, the release of the Mueller report. We are going to talk about it today, but we're going to talk about it in the context of how Georgia's elected officials are responding and what the Mueller report might do in terms of the impact on the 2020 elections here in the state. Joining me, as he does every Friday, Jim Galloway, the lead political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. You read him in the Wednesday and Sunday paper, and he oversees the political insider blog at AJC.com. Hi.
Great weekend coming up.
Yeah, we could all use a little break after the kind of week that we've had in politics. So you're right, the weekend will be very welcome. Amy Steigerwalt is with us. She is a professor of political science, Georgia State University. We're always glad to have you here. Thank you for being with us,
Amy. Thank you for having me again.
Heath Garrett, Republican consultant, works with Johnny Isakson, among other Republicans, not only here in Georgia, but you have clients in across the country.
Across the country. It's great to be here with you.
We've missed you for the last couple of weeks. You've been involved in other activities, so thanks for coming back. And we're glad to welcome back Amir Farouki, who is the city councilman from District 4.
Two.
In the Atlanta City Council. You've got Old Fourth Ward, parts of Midtown, parts of downtown. Got that right?
Yep.
Amy Steigerwalt, you in this district?
I am.
That's
yes.
All right. Good. Yep. So during the breaks, you can do your business with him in terms
exactly.
of like those sidewalk problems.
Where's your lobby?
Midtown Neighborhood Association.
So let's talk a little bit about President Trump's, the way in which the Mueller report characterizes President Trump. Let's take a peek at President Trump himself, who put out an interesting tweet last night. No collusion, no obstruction for the haters and the radical left Democrats. Game over. He's using the Game of Thrones typeface. Amy Steigerwalt doing his best Daenerys Targaryen.
Yes, he is trying to summarize what is a very long and detailed report for the layperson.
Yeah. Jim, let's talk about it. If anybody who's been paying attention to CNN, to Fox, to MSNBC has heard this nonstop. So let's talk about it specifically, if we can, in terms of reaction here in Georgia. I mean, it's no surprise that it's broken down on partisan lines. Let me just give you a couple of the statements that have been made and then start a conversation, and I'll come to you first, Jim. Doug Collins, and you should point this out, Jim, probably the most important Republican in Georgia in terms of the Mueller report, because he is now President Trump's number one defender on Capitol Hill in many ways.
He and Lindsey Graham. Yeah. I mean, Doug Collins is the ranking Republican on the House Judiciary Committee. But you can see the talking points are penetrating, and everyone on the Republican side is getting in line, and they're using the same phrases. David Perdue had something on Facebook. You know, no collusion, no corruption,
no obstruction.
No obstruction.
Yeah.
There we go.
Collins said, and that's exactly right. Collins tweeted, no collusion, no obstruction. No opinion on sitting presidents considered in these determinations, no executive privilege asserted, no redactions proposed or made by anyone outside the Department of Justice, no one outside DOJ viewed the redacted report, no cover-up when there's nothing to cover up. So you're right, there's a talking point theme there. Republican Congressman Rick Allen said the document shows us what we already know. There was no, in all caps, Russian collusion in our 2016 presidential election. So let's talk first about the Republican reaction to all this. There's nothing surprising about the fact that the Republicans in the Georgia delegation at least rallied around.
Number one, you can't be against Trump and win your primary anymore. So everybody understands that. I think if I had to give a very quick summation, I would say it was good enough for Donald Trump to say he's freed of collusion. Of course, that wasn't the charge that anybody was actually looking for, but it was also good enough for Democrats that they can keep chugging along with their investigation and push this thing into the 2020 campaign, which you've already seen those lines jump up.
You know, Heath, that's a really good point. For people who are weary of all of this, and there are many people, whether they are Republicans or Democrats, who are just tired of the back and forth on this. Anyone who was under the faulty illusion that the release of the report would finally bring this to a rest was way off base. This is going to go on, as Jim says, through the 2020 election.
Absolutely. It didn't bring anything to conclusion from a partisan political standpoint. I do think if you go back to the 2020 election and you look at the independent voters, which are a small percentage of the total electorate, though, they are tired of this. And I think that both parties have risk of how they overplay their hand on it. I do think that it's a huge vindication for the president from a political standpoint. Let's put aside whether it's good news that we weren't colluding with the Russians, right? I think that's good for the country. But the Democrats now have interesting talking points. I know we'll get that in a second. But Republicans are absolutely embracing this as a total vindication for the president. And it does allow them to go on and talk about other things. Our Democratic friends are a little bit split on this. I'm not so sure, Jim, this is a great issue for the Democrats to run on in 2020. And you're seeing a little bit of division between the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, and then the rank-and-file Democrats who are already calling for impeachment over this. So I think that's it's a tough for both sides to keep this going.
Amir, so there are some devastating findings in this report that paint a picture of a president who was in fact doing everything he could to stop the investigation and was dissuaded from that by people like his former counsel, Don McGahn, who simply said, "You cannot ask me to fire Robert Mueller. I won't do it." And any number of instances that we see in the report in which the president was stopped from pursuing steps that may very well have, in fact, put him in greater jeopardy for obstruction of justice. So he says it's all partisan. I wonder how you react to that when the report suggests behavior that both Republicans and Democrats might be able to see as meaningful if it weren't for the partisan lens.
Yeah, I think, one, it's important to note that the report said it does not conclude that he committed a crime. It also does not exonerate him either, and which leads to this, I think, division of the Democratic Party. Is do you kind of chase that dog down the path, or do you step back and say, is this really what we should be spending our time on? People are hungry for policy and solutions. Mm-hmm. And I don't think the report tells us anything new. Most people, and I'll be a little bit partisan here, it's a president who lies, his people lie. I think at every step he's undermined traditional democratic norms. And he invited a foreign government to try and influence an election, which I think Republicans and Democrats alike should be and are uncomfortable with. But I think Democrats would be wise not to focus on this report, to move on from it. I think the election in 2020 will be the reckoning or not for President Trump. And I think Democrats, if they're going to win in 2020, need to focus on issues and the path forward and the vision for the country.
Amy, let me bring you in here. And as I do, let me read you just some of the things that Democrats have said in response to the investigation. Teresa Tomlinson, a former panelist on the show until she announced she was forming an exploratory committee to run for the U.S. Senate, said, "Transparency and accountability are essential to our democracy, and the political discomfort or inconvenience of this controversy cannot dissuade our elected officials from promptly completing their constitutional duty." Now, she may be thinking that the constitutional duty is for the Democrats in the House to, in fact, launch an impeachment investigation and move forward in that way. We don't know that for a fact, but she seems to be suggesting that they do have an oversight role here of one sort or another. But Amir makes an interesting point. You know, sometimes one of the smartest things you can do in politics is to let the opposition, when they're experiencing trouble and they're kind of on the ropes, let them hang themselves, stay out of their way. But that's not going to happen here.
I don't think so. And I think some of the problem is that it's not only sort of this political question, but it is, in fact, a very real question about whether or not constitutional norms were violated, whether or not there were actions that were taken that were an abuse of power. And at least in, I think, a lot of the legal community, sort of volume two of the report, because, of course, there's volume one, volume two. Volume one focused on the question of Russian collusion, and volume two focused on the question of obstruction. And volume two was, to many people, and I'll admit that this is how I read it as well in the beginning, was sort of laying out that the person who's supposed to be making this decision is Congress. And there was a lot of reference to Congress's authority to be able to check through separation of powers, about looking to concerns of where there's abuse. And so it was explained as, we're going to lay out the evidence, we're going to preserve the record, and here you go, Congress, do with it what you want. And so I think that that's where the question comes that is very difficult of, how is there a way for us to have a real discussion about what's contained in the report without being blinded by sort of our partisan allegiances and, oh, it's about this person, oh, it's about that person, and instead have a discussion of, well, what if it was a member of the other party, right? How would we be reading this, and would we be having the same reaction and say, oh, my goodness, right, this is not okay? Or would we say, no, these are maybe behaviors that we're not bothered
to that point, there part of me says that volume two is getting far too much attention, and we should be really concentrating on volume
one. So volume two is the section that deals with whether the president was obstructing justice. Mm-hmm. Volume one deals with what has commonly come to be called collusion, but which Robert Mueller makes clear is not a legal term. He was looking at something quite different from so-called collusion.
But you had this is an exoneration of the New York Times, but you have paragraphs in there in which Rick Gates, partner of Paul Manafort, who was the campaign manager for the Trump campaign, quoted as saying that Paul Manafort sat in that famous cigar store, the cigar restaurant, and handed over polling data, talked strategy and messaging with a member known to have connections to Russian security. No one is talking about that.
Yeah, well, and the other thing is, it also very clearly says, right, which is something that I would assume that we could have sort of bipartisan agreement on, that we need to address, that Russia interfered in the election. Right, that forgetting even like whether or not anybody on U.S. soil was helping out, there was in fact an attempt by a foreign government to do that. And what does go to the 2020 election is, are we taking steps to prevent that from happening again? And that's the part that's not really clear.
Heath, I want to get to more Georgia sides of this, but go ahead. You want to respond hearing.
I think there are a couple of things legally. Number one, within the legal theory, there's a big question as to whether or not you can really obstruct justice if the underlying crime was not committed, right? And so as a lawyer, it bothers me that in politics we're now focusing all this on obstruction of justice when the report is very clear that the underlying crime did not happen. They had plenty of data, plenty of resources. There's no allegation that the president or anybody around him obstructed their ability to determine the underlying crime. That should be offensive to all of us as Americans. That's what we call the federal prosecutorial trap. We can't prove you guilty on the underlying crime. We're going to trap you into some little trick of lawyers. And I think that's something we got to be very careful about. Number two, in the volume two, what Mueller was pointing out is that the statute that gives Congress the authority to be a balance on the executive branch was not strong enough for them to come to a conclusion. And so it's not inviting Congress to come in and file obstruction. It's basically saying you need to change the law if you want to. And I think the president's actually been brilliant about saying he doesn't want this to happen to himself anymore or any other president, Republican or Democrat.
Well, you know, again,
that's a bothersome to me, and I didn't like what some of our Republican friends tried to do to Clinton or to Obama. So I think we got to ask that question.
All right, here's the okay. So I keep saying I'd like to talk about how Georgians are reacting to this, but let's just say you're a Georgian reacting to this.
Right.
And let me ask you, and then Amir, you should jump in here. The behavior of the president, as described in this report, it strikes me that Republicans, Democrats, Independents, Some of the way that Mueller describes the president trying to stop the investigation, behaviors that he apparently exhibited when he first learned Mueller was appointed, since the end of my presidency, I am effed. You can't be happy. And clearly the president isn't happy either, because throughout the day after the report being public, his Twitter is lighting up with rage about what the report says about him.
Well, I think, number one, Donald Trump likes this, right? This is the scrum. This is the match. He likes to be able to use the Game of Thrones. He's actually changing the game of politics in real time. We've never seen a president take something.
But how do you feel about this?
Look, I mean, I think that it exposes that the president is a very feisty guy. I think that it exposes some of his personal moral flaws, all of which we've known, which the American people knew when they elected him in 2016. So I don't think it paints him as the kind of person that I invite my children to look up to, but I don't think it paints him to be someone who deserved this two-year,
Okay, so Amir, I heard some man on the street sound bites today on one of the cable networks, and I heard one person particularly who could very well, wasn't a Georgian, but it strikes me could just as well have been a Republican in Georgia, said, and I'm almost quoting verbatim, I think he's a despicable person.
Agreed.
But I believe he's doing a good job for the country, and I'll elect him again. And that brings us closer to home as the question becomes, do we think this is going to have an impact on his reelection chances here in Georgia and on people like David Perdue, who have tied themselves at the hip to President Trump?
Yeah, I think it has an impact on his electability in Georgia to the extent that Democrats focus on it. I think the average voter in Georgia, Republican or Democrat, especially once we get into next year, this is going to be well in the rearview mirror. And Democrats are going to beat Donald Trump with a vision for the future and a set of policies that address the issues that people are grappling with. And I think the more you focus on this report, the more you drum up the Republican base, the more it kind of tires people of politics because you're not offering solutions. And I think there's plenty of Democratic presidential candidates who see that, and I hope we kind of take the higher road and leave the report behind us and move forward.
Jim, here's what Perdue said on Facebook. 2 years and millions of taxpayer dollars have been spent on, and he calls it a wild goose chase. However, Democrats are still pushing a false narrative. They only want to investigate. They do not want to legislate. It's time to move on. No collusion, no obstruction. There are those talking points. No kidding. Here he is, Perdue, once again saying, Trump's my man, and he's got to face election next year.
Right, he does. But to Amir's point, it may not be the Democrats who are talking impeachment come this time next year, because we saw this happen at the close of 18, the 18 election cycle, where Republicans were the ones who were raising impeachment as kind of a foreboding note to turn out the base. And you could easily take Trump's reelection and convert that into an impeachment discussion.
That's right. And I think on the Republican side, I mean, not trying to help my Democratic friends, but I think that hearing Nancy Pelosi and Steny Hoyer, the leaders of the Democratic Party in the House, say impeachment's off the table, yet hearing Nadler and all the other Democrats say no, and the presidential candidates for Democrats all saying no, impeachment's got to be on the table. They have the same problem we as Republicans have. The base is demanding impeachment. Leadership has seen the polling numbers and knows it's not going to help sell the agenda for the Democratic Party. And I think it's interesting. Stacey Abrams has been vocal. Teresa Tomlinson has been vocal. But Lucy McBath and some of the others that are in really close districts that don't feel as emboldened, I think they're being a little quieter because they're trying to figure out how to.
All right, so let's.
But she's also on the Judiciary Committee, correct?
Yeah, which puts her in an interesting position, I think, politically.
I do think it's interesting, Keith, you do make a point. What McBath said is on her tweet is, I'm still reviewing the report. That seems to be the perfect way to frame all this. Right. But then she says, I'm deeply troubled about the findings that the president and his associates put their own personal and political interests above the interests of the American people and our democratic institutions. And she went on and had a much longer statement. So she's sort of threading the needle, I suppose you could say, Amy. But she's making a fairly firm statement that she is offended by the president's behavior as it manifested in the report.
Well, I think some of the problem is, right, I mean, if we sort of put it in a political lens, is that there's a lot of scholarly literature that says it's about framing. It's about how it is that you pitch and using a frame which people respond to. And the president is excellent about framing the narrative, right? No hoax, no collusion, right? This didn't happen. These talking points have been repeated since the beginning, right? It was never, let's do the investigation. I'm, right, you're not going to find anything. Let's get it done. Let's be done with it. We can put it behind us. Instead, it was, this is a hoax. Why are we continuing to do this? And it's a framing that is easy for people to latch on to be able to take. And I think one of the other issues is that it's been very difficult for the Democrats to come up with an alternative framing that puts it in, right? Sometimes the longer, right, we should slow down, we should wait, we should read it, we should see what it is. And in many ways, right, it's also, if what you wanted was a clear thing, right, that's definitely not what the Mueller report gave you, right? The Mueller report starts out and says on the question of obstruction, well, we actually can't answer this anyways because OLC says we can't indict the president, so we're going to give you some info and then do with it what you want. Again, framing that is very difficult. It is easy, though, to latch on to the bottom line, which is that the president was not indicted for obstruction. Right.
Let me bring this back to David Perdue, Jim, if I may. So I get it. A Lucy McBath in the 6th District, as Heath points out, there's, you know, it's still not clear that it's a blue district. She's going to face significant efforts to get her oust her from office. In most of the Republican-controlled congressional seats here, they're safe. Nothing's going to change. But David Perdue has to run statewide.
He has to run statewide.
President Trump is at 40%, according to your last polling, of approval ratings. And I will be stunned if next week we see polling that shows that he hasn't either remained at the same point, despite what he claims is his exoneration, or lost a little ground, at least.
Right, right. And you have to remember the thing that separates David Perdue from Brian Kemp right now are the northern suburbs of metro Atlanta.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And in that way, I think it's very interesting. I think David Perdue and Karen Handel are kind of tied together. I mean, I don't want to diss Brandon Beach, who's also in the primary, in the Republican primary, and those two have to come head to head. But if Karen Handel is going to have a rematch with Lucy McBath, the rematch that she wants, then she's going to have to answer the Trump question just like David Perdue is going to. And I think one might follow the lead of the other in that case.
And I might frame it just a little bit differently, Bill. I do think that David Perdue's tweet there is a little bit of, I'm glad this is over. I'm already wed to him, so I'm not going to disown him, which would be a mistake for him to do in the base, right?
Right.
But thank goodness it does kind of come to this conclusion that there was no collusion, right? And now, hopefully, we as Republicans, at least, even though Democrats aren't going to let us do it, are going to move away from having to talk about it all the time. And we do have a bumper sticker, right? Then this is where Trump's brilliance shines through.
No collusion, no obstruction.
Oh. And then you use Game of Thrones, and so now we have the producer of Game of Thrones entering the debate nationally, and nobody's talking about anything else but Donald Trump.
Yeah, I would stop short of saying the Democrats are the ones hanging on to this conversation. The president's tweeting about it, you know, right now.
The president's Twitter stream today has been breathtaking in its rage against the report.
Yeah. I mean, look, he's his own worst enemy. And I think he will win or lose. All of his flaws are on the table. His shortcomings are on the table. Everyone knows what they are. The path to beating him is not through this report. It's through charting a different path and putting up a different type of person to run the highest office in the land. And so, I don't want to beat a dead horse, but I think Democrats would be wise to stay away from impeachment, move away from the report, and articulate a vision for the country.
All right, let's do this. Let's get our first break of the show out of the way. And when we come back, let's change the subject. This week, not one, but two Democratic presidential candidates were in Atlanta. Let's talk about their messaging as they came into town, because, in fact, they talked about very specific Georgia issues. This is Political Rewind. We'll be right back.
Welcome to GPB's Stealth Drive, an innovative way of fundraising on the air this spring. It's all about giving you more programming and less fundraising. Support GPB now at 800-222-4788 or gpb.org and choose from a variety of great thank you gifts, including tickets to see best-selling author and humorist David Sedaris before they go on sale to the public. David Sedaris will be at the Fox Theater in Atlanta on Wednesday, November 20th, and the Classic Center in Athens on Wednesday, December 4th. For a limited time only, with your credit card contribution of $300, select a pair of tickets to an evening with David Sedaris in either Atlanta or Athens as your thank you gift. You'll also join us for GPB's exclusive pre-show reception. Don't wait. Call 800-222-4788 now or give online at gpb.org. And thanks.
Jim Galloway, Cory Booker, Democratic candidate for president, was in town this past week. And he seems to be picking up a theme, not surprisingly, that other Democratic candidates who've come in have picked up on. And that's their belief in that there's been a huge voter suppression effort that elected Brian Kemp, governor, calling, as he did, for more transparency, for an investigation of Brian Kemp as Secretary of State. This is a theme that Democratic, and Andrew Yang, the candidate who people don't know a whole lot about it at this point, but he's raised enough money, apparently, that he'll actually be in the debate. Yeah. He, too, raising these issues of voter suppression and a need for more transparency and to have, in Booker's case, automatic voter registration.
Well, I think this is just a remarkable show of how Stacey Abrams has set the conversation, at least in Georgia and probably throughout the South, for these presidential candidates as they come through here.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right.
No, Amy. I think it's exactly right. And I think it's also, you know, pulling off of measures that we've seen in other places as well, right, especially with felon disenfranchisement, right? So the idea that once you're done, either while you're still in prison or after you finish your sentence, are you allowed to get your voting rights back? And also real questions about how do we allow people to not only register to vote, but actually vote itself? So we've seen sort of movements on the West Coast towards vote by mail, and that's certainly one of the things also that Booker was talking about.
Amir, it's not, it is certainly, as Jim points out, the way Stacey Abrams has gotten her message across, but it's also the way the national media covered the 2018 elections here in Georgia. And we've said this before on our show, but the national media, the New York Times, Washington Post, the major national newspapers, and the cable news, the more liberal cable news networks, they didn't have any question in their minds, in their coverage, that there was vast voter suppression. The way we looked at it on the ground here was we said over and over again, we need to see a little bit more evidence. But that became part of the national narrative, and now the presidential candidates are bringing it into Georgia with them.
Yeah, yes. I think the national narrative, it's a compelling one, right? It sells newspapers. It may play into a broader narrative of things in the South are not as they should be. But there was, in fact, voter suppression here. I mean, you have precincts in rural counties getting closed. They shouldn't be getting closed. You have people getting purged from the voter rolls. You know, Amy brings up a great point, is that you look at states that allow vote by mail, voter participation is incredibly high, higher than anywhere else in the country. And we need to be looking at ways to expand access to the polls for everyone who's legal to vote. And we don't. We're doing the opposite. And it comes across as a partisan attempt to maintain power. And I think as we think about access to voting, we need to be very honest about the fact that we are not being as fair and open as we should be. But, you know, the national versus local narrative, while it may be exaggerated at the national level, there's a kernel of truth there.
Yeah, we saw issues here, too. We just were a little bit more careful in making decisions. A lot of it was based on the fact that Kemp didn't recuse himself from the election as Secretary of State. Go ahead.
And I want to talk about this, right? I think this is a real concern for us in the state of Georgia, and this show's done a good job of talking about the facts around this, but there's no question there's a very discouraging national narrative going around that Georgia was suppressing votes in 2018 like we were in the 1950s or 1960s, and the New York Times, the Washington Post, and these other newspapers were glad to write that narrative without writing the story. We had historic turnout. We had the largest voter participation in the state's history. Stacey Abrams got more votes than any other Democrat in history, more so than Hillary Clinton. We had the highest African-American turnout, the highest Hispanic turnout. There was no what we would view legal as voter suppression. However, you can make these arguments about whether we should have mail-in ballots or make it easier to register, but the facts are there's not one one single person who's been able to come forward and testify in a court of law that they were denied the right to vote.
That's the narrative that's out there,
and I think it's irresponsible, and it makes us look bad.
If I could jump in here. Number one, the one thing that the national media really just couldn't wrap its head around is that we have a Secretary of State who is formally in charge of statewide elections, right, but we have 159 counties, mm-hmm, all with election officials that also operate independently. However, now to your point that there was no evidence, if you look at HB 318, which was the bill that authorizes the purchase of voting machines, right, it incorporates into that language the contents of five Democratic bills targeting the problems that Stacey Abrams pointed out, like exact match. Those were Republican admissions that she had her point. Yeah. During that campaign.
But I think we made that point all along, right? There's no coverage of the fact that Republicans, so these are good ideas. It didn't prevent anybody from getting a chance to vote in 2018.
The only thing with that is because there were a number of federal courts that had to step in, right? Because we had issues with ballots that were being rejected, right? I mean, again, it was focused in counties. It wasn't statewide because
primarily counties that are controlled by the Democratic Party in Georgia.
All right. I don't want to relitigate the 2018 election. I raise that largely to say presidential candidates are paying attention and they're bringing that issue to the state, not maybe to win some Georgia votes, but they see that as the state is being used to attract voters across the country, and to his point, it doesn't make us look so
good.
But
it's almost an entry fee if you're a presidential candidate.
Well, as is both Booker and Yang, when they came in, talked about the heartbeat abortion bill as an example of the direction that Republicans are taking the country. Now, that, Heath, strikes me. Here in Georgia, I thought the AJC polling on this was fascinating. Mm-hmm. Because I don't have the numbers exactly in front of me, Jim, but I think 49% of the people were surveyed said they believe that abortion should remain legal.
No, actually, 70%.
Oh, 70% said it should be legal.
We're against doing away with Roe v. Wade.
I'm sorry, but 49% didn't have a real problem with the heartbeat bill,
right,
which is bizarre.
It was split right down
the middle. That's right, which is really hard to understand. But, Heath, this is an issue that I would think Democrats are going to win some votes on. If you're Cory Booker, you can make something out of this.
Well, there's no question that Democrats are going to use this as an issue. I think there's a question in 2020, is there any other issue on any ballot other than Donald Trump for Democrats, right? So to me, this is a hook issue like others might be. However, I think I've said it on the show, and I think I've heard a lot of Republicans say this. You can agree from a public policy standpoint, theologically, from a philosophical standpoint, and from a public policy standpoint, that the heartbeat bill has some scientific legitimacy to concern. Republicans have to acknowledge that abortion's not been a good issue for them with independent swing women in the state of Georgia or any other suburb in America. And so I think that's the politics of it.
Amy, if you're a Democrat running for president and you come to any of the few states out there now, Texas being another one that have these heartbeat bills, you can make some mileage out of this in your campaigns by running against it.
You most decidedly can. I mean, it's an issue which not only motivates, right, Republican base, but it also very much so motivates the Democratic base. And it's also one where it helps, again, the messaging, there's a sort of clear link that it can sort of feed into a larger narrative about wanting to, right, stop people from gaining in their careers, right? It really sort of ties into sort of broader arguments about how it is that women are doing in obtaining jobs and moving up the ladder. It ties into questions about equal pay. And it also sort of ties into this sort of visual that we're dealing with now, both I think in Georgia and more nationally, that the Republican Party, especially elected officials in the Republican Party, are much more white and male than they have been in past years. And so again, sort of back to that picture that we saw of Renee Unterman with her 34 right, male colleagues behind her, it really sort of feeds into this and this question of where do women and where do minorities fit into the Republican Party?
Bill, I think one thing we need to do is recognize kind of the shift this is within the Democratic Party. Again, 2018 was the first time, probably in two decades, where we saw abortion become a general election issue for Democrats.
Yeah.
I mean, we have moved so far away from the Clinton years where abortion was spoken of as something that should be legal and rare.
Amir, State Senator Nakeem Williams, now the chair of the Democratic Party here in Georgia, is listening, as she often does, to the show. She sent this message to us. Language, this is something you'll appreciate, Amy, but Amir, language and messaging matters. HB 481 is an abortion ban, and we need to call it what it is. So we've been saying it all but outlaws abortion, yeah. Which is, of course, correct, but she suggests that it is a ban. So I just thought we'd bring that.
Look, it is effective. I think what's and Amy touched on this. This is an extreme proposal. It's kind of Republicans who backing this or grasping at straws as a way to kind of maintain some sort of narrative as the state shifts to the middle and women are more active in politics. Frankly, women are the only people we should be asking this question of, and women in Georgia don't want to see this happen, and they're the ones who should be making this decision. And I think this is enormous overreach by Republicans, and the chickens will come home to roost next.
All right, let's move on to another subject. I'll just close it by saying, Jim, we're only beginning to see a stream of Democratic presidential candidates who will come into this state in the months ahead. And certainly once we get Brad Raffensperger, the Secretary of State, to set an actual date for the primary, we'll really start seeing him come in as 2020 begins, for
right,
sure.
Right, right. It's hard to prioritize if you're a presidential candidate.
Yeah, you don't know what the calendar is. Yeah. All right, well, we need to ask Raffensperger why they haven't put that date on the calendar.
Let's bring him on the show.
All right, we'll do that. I think that's a good idea. Let's move on. Let's talk just a little about campaign fundraising. We just came to the end of a fundraising cycle. And as you all pointed out in the Insider, there's already been millions of dollars raised. David Perdue, the candidates, both Democrats and Republicans in the 6th and 7th congressional districts. This state's going to be bringing a lot of money in, not necessarily just from Georgians, but from outside. Lucy McBath shows first quarter fundraising of $481,000, handle $238,000. Not bad considering she jumped in toward the end of the cycle. Brandon Beach, not doing quite as well. Jim, you mentioned that we shouldn't discount him, but he's not quite on fire yet.
He did have a session.
He couldn't raise money during a session. In the 7th District, Carolyn Bordeaux, these are the Democrats, of course, she's done very well. She did well last time when she was the Democratic candidate in there. And as you can see, the other two candidates not in such great shape. But the money, do we have David Perdue, I think, as well on this? Perdue has raised, what, two? He raised
2.5, I think, in the quarter and has $4 million on hand.
Yeah, he raised.
That number becomes very important. Okay, 1.7 in the quarter.
Okay, why does that number become important?
Because every day that Democrats in Georgia don't have a U.S. Senate candidate is a day that they are not raising money to match that.
Amir, that is so true. I mean, we are waiting. Anyway, Teresa Tomlinson we mentioned earlier, she's got her exploratory committee going, but she is in this awkward place where she's got to say, I'm running for Senate unless Stacey Abrams jumps in. Democrats have got to be getting more and more frustrated almost by the day at this point.
Well, look, I think there's plenty of time here, but
The
longer Stacey Abrams does not make a decision, the more it helps David Perdue, to Jim's point. And I think Teresa can, and if is the only candidate, will be a very formidable opposition to Senator Perdue. But people are still waiting to see what Stacey's going to do. And she's going to galvanize the party and Georgians in a remarkable way if she jumps in. But she's kind of hit the pause button, and so Democrats are, I think, getting a bit antsy.
Yes. I mean,
you're not here as a Democrat, so.
I'm here as that. I mean, but when it looks at fundraising, I mean, every day, I mean, as Jim said, every day that you're not raising money and also every day that you're not campaigning is one less day that you get to raise money and to campaign. And it means that the sort of not only is there no one currently running against Perdue, but it also means the party has really sort of stopped its efforts as well, right? It's kind of ignoring the race until it gets to that because it's not sure what to do.
That is so important, Jim. if Abrams decides to get in the race, she can raise extraordinary amounts of money very quickly. But if she doesn't, Teresa Tomlinson,
they're going to need some help.
Anybody else who jumps in,
Raphael Warnock,
it's going to be harder, for them to raise him. It'll be interesting.
Well,
Bill, that's the
point I was going to make. Is that I would encourage Stacey to stay on her book tour around the country, and keep this going. If I were on David Perdue's staff, right? Because if she gives in, it's probably not a big deal. But if she doesn't get in, it's a terrible disservice to the other candidates, whether that's Teresa Tomlinson or Raphael Warnock or any of the other folks who've thought about running. I mean, I hear Jen Jordan's name now being, bandied around as a serious candidate. These folks have no name recognition and no money, and you've got to have that in order to be a credible challenger.
We got to take a break, but the point to be made, I think, especially about the 6th and 7th congressional fundraising so far, is that, once again, those two districts are going to be big, hotly contested races, and there's going to be a lot of money pouring in to those districts as the election moves forward. All right, let's do this. Let's get our final break of the show out of the way. Back with more Political Rewind in just a minute.
This spring here at GPB, our goal is to cover the cost of the programs you love and hopefully eliminate the spring fund drive. How? Well, instead of cutting into the programs you listen to on GPB, like we do during a traditional fund drive, you'll hear short reminders like this one. We're calling it GPB Stealth Drive. Hi, I'm Tom Barclay, GPB's radio operations manager. People who listen just like you're doing right now provide the single most important and reliable funding for everything you hear on GPB. So right now, we're counting on your support. So while you're thinking about it, call 800-222-4788, 800-222-4788, or donate online at gpb.org. Because public radio matters to you, do it now, and thank you so much.
We're back on Political Rewind. Jim, the AJC carried a story on the front page of the paper this past week. Another story about David Ralston and the delays, the continuances he has asked for in dealing with clients of his based on his duties as Speaker of the House down at the Capitol. Now, there was no really new information about the facts of his continuances, but what was surprising, and what I think put it on the front page, was the enumeration. More than 900 times he has asked for continuances in 266 cases. Now, we should say these figures come from an independent investigator.
Right, a private investigator allied with, in some fashion, we don't know how, with the dissidents in the House Republican.
The people who want Ralston out. So your reporters, as of the publication, had not been able to independently verify it. But the reason it's worth talking about is it makes clear to us that despite the fact that Ralston tried to take some steps to put this completely behind him, there is going to be an effort to keep it alive.
Right, right. At least to keep it alive, at least probably through next year's primary.
Sure.
And it does paint a picture of a practice that could be built around delay. Delay of the justice system.
Well, and as an attorney, I do want to jump in here because I've talked to a number of my Democratic friends on this. I got some real concerns about these numbers. We're talking about 266 cases. That's an average.
No, we're talking, 266 clients.
Yeah, cases.
900 continuances.
Right, which is an average of just over 3 continuances per case. Anybody who's engaged in a criminal defense practice, there are cases that our firm has had with no legislators in our firm where we've had as many as 20 and 25 continuances. And so I think that we have to put these numbers into context, right? Small town lawyers across rural Georgia have continuances all the time. The question is, right, in what context was this? I don't think these numbers are outside the norm. I do think it's legitimate political fodder, and the speaker's going to have to deal with it for a long period of time. But I don't think we need to run lawyers out of the legislature because they're doing things that are pretty normal in their
Work. That's one point that hasn't been explored is. Mm-hmm. Is taking a look at other lawyers who serve in the House and Senate.
I think that's right. But here's what I think is interesting about this, Amir. At a time when Democrats are beginning to take hold in the state legislature, beginning to add seats. We think that in 2020, we know they're making a big push to add even more Democrats in the House, particularly. Here's a speaker who is facing some real strong criticism and efforts to get him out of there by people within his own party. It's a dynamic that's got to be troubling to the Republicans in that body.
That's okay. I mean, there's two conversations here. One is whether he should remain Speaker of the House, and that's a question for the Republican caucus. The second is a question of whether he should be in office at all, and that's a question for the voters of Blue Ridge and surrounds. And I think Democrats are wise to let that conversation play out on its own and focus on their own seats and races and articulating the vision for Georgia.
Yeah, I assume Ralston could be primaried. Certainly, if this continues to gain steam, whether he loses or he's been primary before,
twice,
and it hasn't worked, but we're not likely to see that seat suddenly become Democratic. It's just when the Republican leadership of the House is facing some close scrutiny at a time when Democrats are trying to establish more power there, it's a dynamic that has got to be troubling, as I said to Amir.
It is. And I mean, it's also one that makes it more difficult, right, for Speaker Ralston to keep his caucus together when he's trying to lead the House. It makes it more difficult to just lead the House on a day-to-day basis because, right, you need the Speaker, right, you need everyone, in fact, right, to be playing along. I mean, the Georgia House has a lot more collegiality than people realize. They actually work very well together across the aisles, right? Jen Jordan is one of the chair people, right, of one of the committees. So, I mean, there are, in fact, it's not just that they're all minority dominated.
That's in the Senate.
Sorry, she's in the Senate, but I think there's a couple, concept. I think, in the...
Scott Holcomb and the Speaker have a good relationship in the House.
Yes, and so I think one of the things that's in there is that also sort of makes that difficult is how that's going to be. And so when you start to have this bubbling up in the middle of the Republican caucus, right, I mean, I think what Democrats are doing are staying out of the way and saying, well, we're going to let you all do this and figure it out, but it's going to need to either be shut down or it's going to have to be addressed.
You know, it's... Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, my message to my Republican clients and friends is a lot of whom have never been in the minority, right, that are in that House of Representatives. Bill, you're making great at giving good advice to Republicans, which is be careful what you wish for because the Democrats could, take back the House or the Senate in the next two or three cycles, particularly with a lot of Republican infighting.
Right. It is a 15-seat margin right now.
Yeah.
And it is extremely important for Democrats to do well in 2020 because they won't have the governor's mansion. And the only way they can get a seat at the table when redistricting comes around is to make themselves invaluable or to rule the House or make them so crucial that they can't be ignored.
Well, you know, it strikes me there's another thing to consider here, Jim. And that's that if Democrats are taking joy in this, yes, they'd like to win the majority, and certainly that is a big, big goal. But if they can't, David Ralston has been a fair-minded speaker who has been the guy, the cop who has stopped, in many cases, some particularly pernicious legislation from passing, legislation the Democrats certainly have not liked. So, I mean, he's been a force there that Democrats have been happy with. Now, the abortion bill happens to be an exception to that, and it's a strong one.
The business community, too.
Yeah.
So don't forget that. But, I mean, I think you have House Democrats playing a very long game that looks to the history of North Carolina, where you had some deal making going on between your majority of Republicans and a piece of the Democrats.
All right, let's move on. Jim, 6 years ago, Nathan Deal, who early in his tenure as governor, took on some immigration issues. He apparently felt a need. I won't doubt his sincerity, but he was also playing strongly to his anti-immigrant base, passed some legislation that was harmful in many ways to undocumented residents of Georgia. But he also created the Immigration Enforcement Review Board. we struggled for 6 years to figure out exactly what that board was supposed to be all about.
It was designed to keep a watch on local governments and make sure they adhere to state law regarding employment of illegal immigrants.
Okay, and the immigration board, which had appointments from the speaker, from the lieutenant governor, from the governor, had 20 cases brought to before it in 6 years, 19 of them from
D.A. King.
King, one of the most, Heath, what's the word I want to use here?
Aggressive.
One of the most aggressive anti-immigrant voices in the state of Georgia.
No question. And look, as a Republican, D.A. King is a great example of how one member of the grassroots organization can get outsized influence within a political party or within a caucus. And whether it's because of some local newspapers or whether it was because he grabbed onto an issue that clearly was a wedge issue in primaries, I'm not a big fan of D.A. King. I'll be real honest about that and don't think Republicans should have been listening to him all along from a political standpoint. However, this is what happens when you have one person who's so vocal about something and politicians just wanted to give him something to do, and so they created a commission that they're now getting rid of.
He's a troublemaker. Thinking the same thing.
We got to talk about the 20th case.
Okay.
The 20th case was a complaint that came from Lieutenant Governor Casey Cagle against the city of Decatur.
Right.
He lost that case.
Right.
The state had to pony up $12,000 in legal fees. So it was not used very wisely, and it cost money.
Yeah. All right. Let's, Amir, why don't you jump in here? By the way, we should say that when he says there was a newspaper that helped him, D.A. King, get where he was, the Marietta Daily Journal gave him a platform. He had a column in there that he was using to spread his anti-immigrant message.
I think the Immigration Enforcement Review Board was a exercise in institutionalized xenophobia driven by D.A. King, and I'm not sure how much of an issue this shift is in. Both, it was passed unanimously by both houses to disband this, and I think we're ready to move on. There is still, you know, a xenophobic conversation going on. Senator Perdue kind of banging the drum of a five-alarm emergency at the national border, which is just fundamentally false, and I think buying into President Trump's narrative. But look, this is it's a state that I'm the child of an immigrant who immigrated here in the late 1960s, and I'm the child of immigrants who immigrated here eight generations ago to Georgia in the late 1700s. We're all immigrants. This is a state that's going to flourish based on immigration, a country that's going to flourish based on immigration. It has and will continue to. And I think our policies, while we may need immigration reform, need to reflect a more open mindset.
All right. The reason I brought this up, and I want to get to this, even though we're short on time, is that Governor Kemp now has a bill sitting on his desk, the purpose of which was completely different from a measure that ended up, I guess this is one of those 40th day measures that we're suddenly realizing, the bill calls for the disbanding of this Immigration Enforcement Review Board. And this is a guy who ran a primary campaign on saying he's going to go out with his pickup truck and pick up undocumented Georgians. I don't know what he's going to do with this measure and whether it is going to be, if he signs the bill, how his base is going to respond.
Well, I mean, this is one of those things where we sort of take a step back that suggests that sometimes, right, we perhaps have a good intention for why we create something, and then it turns out it simply doesn't work. And so stopping the thing that doesn't work doesn't mean we don't care about the issue. It means that this thing doesn't work. And it's turned out that this board costs a lot of money.
You might have some people talking in Brian Kemp's ear right now saying this would be a good idea. If you want to come across as somebody who is moving more toward the middle, and
Sign the bill
with pro business policy, go ahead and sign.
Well, but, and you can also say it will save the state money. It costs money to run an independent commission.
I think it's the right thing to do from a public policy standpoint, and it happens to be good politics for Republicans, right, who are constantly being accused of being xenophobic, even when you raise legitimate questions about border security and immigration policy, which is fundamentally flawed. And we all know it, and nobody can come together to fix it, Republican or Democrat.
Heath Garrett, you got the last word on today's Political Rewind. That is Heath Garrett. Jim Galloway has been with us. Jim, you'll be back with me for Monday's show, I'm glad to say. Amir Farouki and Amy Steigerwald, thank you, too. for being here for a terrific discussion today. That's all the time we have for Political Rewind today. As I said, we'll be back here on Monday at 2. Please join us then. I'm Bill Nigut. See ya.